Ms. Wiggins, you're up again, and you know what we're interested in. So tell us why, in this case, the district court should be reversed.
The Supreme Court said that these to force a person against their will should be relatively rare. But it was, of a person's liberty interest to do this. And so in some cases, shown, but it should be rare. This case as posing the question of, if this is relatively rare, what is not relatively rare? He is a nonviolent person accused of white-collar fraud crimes that are sadly commonplace, but it's a fairly well-established area of federal law. He has already done a huge amount of the time he might do by both sides and the district court's estimate.
Remind me, he faces a 70 to 87 guideline sentence. How much time has he done?
One more time. We missed you.
Mr. Slavin is a few days short of 55 months.
All right,
he's
been in custody less time than the sentence he's liable to get, and you're asking the district court to dismiss the charges. Don't those factors cut in favor of the government in this case?
Supreme Court didn't say, if they still have a few months left, that's an important enough reason to forcibly medicate them. Here, possibly be restored to competency. That would take at least 4 months. Then the case has to work itself out. So I believe he will be at just about time served.
So, counsel, can I ask you about this? And because this is something that occurred to me, and it actually relates more to the last case, but it seems like for cases that have a guideline range that starts roughly at the 2.5 to 3 years to some maximum, inevitably those cases will always be, by the time they actually get to the Court of Appeals and work their way through system, they're going to be at the the minimum guideline range will have basically been eaten up by the pretrial confinement stuff. And so, and we see that, I think, in the Gillenwater case, I believe, and in the, I'm going to butcher the name, but the Unaha case.
Thank you. I've been trying to pronounce that for myself for a while.
Well, I'm sure I didn't say it right.
Serious cases.
But in those cases, and obviously the case we just heard, so If we had a rule, if we agreed with you on the rule that if you're kind of up to the minimum, well, in those cases they didn't. What they did is they relied on the confinement after the government interest in, I forget what it's called, but after somebody's been sentenced and they're out, but they're under supervised release. But it seems to me like what's really going on in those cases is, otherwise we just have a hard and fast rule that if it was a roughly 3-year sentence, none of those people would ever be medicated. You see the problem with that, because they're always going to, that time's going to be eaten up just to get to us, right? So what do we do with that?
Asking for that as a hard and fast rule, and I don't think Sell asked for that. I think what Sell says is that, in both of these cases today, we're saying, yes, it's a serious offense. What Self says is look at whether that is weakened. And one of the things you look at is that they already done so much time in pretrial custody that the personal deterrent effect of this is sort of almost washed away, because they've already been incapacitated for as long as you can do that. So I wouldn't ask for a hard and fast rule. Onuaha is a great example of a case where the person had done, that 2-3 years, and yet this court found there's something about this case that is extraordinary, and the public has a right to see it prosecuted.
Well, that's something.
Back to the guidelines. The guidelines in in Mr. Slavin's case are quite long. Is there any case in which this circuit has held that that a person did not, that the government had not met the first cell factor in a case where the guidelines were as long as they are in this case?
I believe so. And I'm not saying that, you know, 55 to 70 months is not long enough. I mean, in both cases, I don't think you look at the length to say, is it serious?
Well, you surely look at it. It's a factor in looking to see whether it's serious. And this is a pretty large fraud scheme. And fraud is a serious crime, even though, as you say, it's well established. And there are victims. So why isn't this a pretty serious offense? It may not end the analysis, but it surely gives the government an interest in prosecuting. So what cuts the other way in this case?
Well, we think it's a serious offense, but what mitigates it is the amount of time he's done, the fact that he's nonviolent, and the fact that that the government might have, or teaching the public about the scope of criminal law and how serious some things are. The public knows serious. He's been charged and detained for a very long time. So it's, in that sense, I think the seem to say, yes, this is the rare case where we need forcible medication. And again, it should said. They said, oh, because it's a white-collar crime and the general deterrence of getting a criminal conviction is great. And I believe that by charging him and holding him so long, that interest has been served enough that the government's interest has so weakened that this is not one of the rare cases where forcible medication is appropriate.
Have we not said that, for example, in tax cases, general deterrence is a very important consideration in evaluating the value of a criminal prosecution as opposed to some sort of civil process. Because with tax cases, and I'm asking, wouldn't that be true with respect to white-collar fraud, the economic system depends on a certain level of trust and confidence that the laws will be enforced. And so wouldn't that argue in favor of prosecution or putting more weight on the general deterrence factor? And you're arguing with respect to Mr. Slavin that we focus on the individual deterrence.
That fraud is a serious crime and should be the subject of federal prosecution. And I certainly have no issue with the fact that federal charges were brought in this case. The argument is that, yes, he's been federally indicted. He's been held for a long time. If
I can't hear you, but I will say that I have a hard time with the argument that an indictment, which is not evidence of any kind and is not to be taken as any sort of indication of guilt, that the indictment itself should be taken by the public as a message that the government takes this sort of thing seriously. We're not going to actually prosecute you, but by golly, we're going to indict you. It's a kind of a perversion of the notion of what an indictment is.
Well, the only reason this indictment wouldn't go forward is because you have a defendant who is severely mentally ill. I mean, and these officers are great at finding malingering, and they have it with him. And so it's a unique, rare situation, and it's not because it's not a serious crime. It's because of a very unique defendant who was not competent to stand trial.
Ms. Wiggin, I'll give you a minute for rebuttal when we're done because we've taken you over.
Thank you.
And I apologize for your name on our docket sheet is Wiggins, but I know your name is Wiggins, so I've gone back and forth, and I apologize for that. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Matthew Fusen for the United States. I'd like to start with the question about deterrence. I think it's fairly clear from this court's cases that deterrence, or at least in Onawaha, where the statement was that mere detention does not serve deterrence alone, but it's the fact of conviction that benefits society with respect to deterrence. I think that's important in this case. What I also think is important, going back to the questions about the guidelines, are that this is a defendant who, as he sits here today, has served over a year less than the low end of his guideline sentence and 32 months less than the high end. So and going to Judge Erickson's question about that, this court has never looked at a case where there's that type of delta and held that the special circumstance of time in custody extinguished the government's interest.
Well, have we ever found a case in which we've said no, you ought to dismiss the charges? When I go through the cases in the circuit, we have apparently each time affirmed a district court determination that the drugs ought to be administered. Do you know of a case that comes out the other way in this circuit? Not in the district court.
As to the first factor, I don't know of a case. We're looking at the important governmental interest.
Well, there's never been a case that I can find in this circuit that has reversed a district court order to administer psychotropic drugs. There are some district court orders the other way that says, no, we'll dismiss the charges, but for some reason the government hasn't appealed those. So am I right in thinking there's no circuit cases here that in effect come out in favor of the defendant?
Correct, Your Honor. No circuit cases that come out in favor of the defendant on that first factor.
Okay, so here's my difficulty in general, and I'm not sure how it applies to these two cases in particular. There does arrive a point at which the government's interest in prosecuting somebody who has been held in custody for all the time he would have served otherwise becomes so diminished that we're not going to invade the defendant's personal liberty and administer these drugs. And our cases say we review the district court's determination de novo, which is to say we look at the record and try to figure out when that point is reached. How do we do that? I have the same problem in both cases. It's almost always going to be a crime that has some seriousness to it, where the defendant in most cases is going to be approaching, if not past, the time of the sentence. In your case, in this case, it's not. We're not quite there, and we may or may not have any evidence in the record about civil commitment. So how do we do this job? Tell us how we do it.
Your Honor, what I would say to that is certainly at a point, at the time served goes beyond the guideline maximum or the estimated guideline maximum, the interest could become less, the government's interest, right? I mean, I think especially that's a point in itself that the analysis would change and the government's burden would be much more difficult. But looking at the established precedent in this circuit, that's just not the case here. With Onuahu, middle of the guideline range at the time of the appeal, and then comes back up on second appeal and the defendant had already served longer than the guideline range. But the court still upheld the government's interest. And Gillenwater was a month less than the low end, whereas here we have 15 months less. So
Judge Erickson.
How long is the guideline supervised release in Mr. Slay? Is this a 5-year presumptive supervised release term?
I believe it's a 3-year, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Would it be appropriate to look at the importance of supervised release restrictions in connection with the type of crime? So with supervised release of a white-collar defendant in a fraud case, you would have financial restrictions, inability to have a trust relationship with anyone for money. Are those factors that this court has taken into consideration before, and would they be appropriate to take into consideration here?
So looking at the cases, specifically with respect to fraud or white-collar cases, I don't believe the court has looked at supervised release. Certainly the court in Gillenwater and Awaha looked at supervised release as, you know, posing to the time spent in custody. And here, I do think it's very important with a white-collar case. There are a few things, right? I mean, supervised release, the idea that it's rehabilitative and, you know, increases the odds of the defendant's success. But exactly what you said, Judge Erickson, we'll have financial restrictions, we'll have, you know, restitution placed in order, and we'll also have the ability of the district court to impose special conditions such as psychotherapy. And through the analysis, the district court could also impose medication, right? Could
follow the recommendations of a physician. Usually it's follow the recommendations of your mental health provider, yeah.
Exactly, which would all be available for the district court here. So it's not only deterrence, but as well, the benefit of supervised release. So I agree with both of those.
One of the things that strikes me in both of these cases, and I'm not suggesting it occurred in any bad fashion, is the recommendation for the use of the drugs occurs after the defendant has been in custody, if you will, for a substantial period of time. Should there be, and I understand use of the drugs is a last resort, we don't want to do it first, but should there be some burden on the government to move more quickly in these cases so that we don't have the sentence almost served, if you will, before we get to this point?
I mean, it is the time, the restrictions and the limits, and the time itself is statutory. And I guess putting it on the government is a bit speculative or working out procedurally, because it is, like in this case, it's the defendant who seeks the competency hearing. Certainly in other cases, it could be the government, but it's the defendant here who seeks it, goes through the process of a first psychiatrist coming to the court and saying, you know, yes, this defendant is mentally incompetent, and then following 4241, to go through that process, you know, it is statutory. And as this court has said before, the Bureau of Prisons here went through the Harper hearing to see if there was another reason to administer antipsychotics. That wasn't there. So then that's when it came back to the district court for the cell hearing. So in this case, it followed the statutory guidelines as to time, and that all started when the defendant first sought.
And I say in this case, the defendant is not complaining about delay in the process.
And speedy trial is told during all that time because it's a motion by the defendant, correct?
Correct.
But it does strike me that when the sentence is as long as this one, it is a little, it would be an easier case to determine were we at an earlier point in the proceedings. And I understand it's not nobody's fault. It's just an observation. You've got a little bit of time left.
If there are no further questions, Your Honor, the government would just request that this court affirm the order of the district court.
Thank you. And let's give Ms. Wiggin a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Brief. I think I was able to make most of my points in the opening. I would just say if we're looking at supervised release, two points I want to make. One is, side briefed this, so these cases are not in our briefs, but in
we've lost you again for a second.
In terms of force forcing a person to take antipsychotics on supervised release. I believe this court has sort of a heightened test that you'll find in the cases Cope and Williams. And it's not going to be a simple matter. And also, you want to avoid the analysis including future dangerousness, which Sell says not to do. But the other thing, I guarantee he'll be on supervised release. Interestingly, after two appeals, many, many months over what he was facing, Mr. Onuahu was acquitted in district court. So this case is going, I would not force medication just for supervised release. Thank you.
Was that a not guilty by reason of insanity?
Sir, I could brief that if you would like.
No, we can.
We can
find it.
It's a public record. we'll figure it out. I thank you to both counsel for their arguments and briefing in this case. And United States versus Slavin will be submitted.